From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? I currently find myself in sunny Cayman Islands, in close proximity to AIF James himself, our producer. Rog, where are you this week?
Hey, I'm in my house.
Are you allowed out of your house?
I'm not sure. It's pretty serious here, mate. So they're saying to everybody to avoid contact and stay as much as you can in the house.
Listen, I've seen how much Italians kiss each other. This is a problem.
Well, you know, that's the point, really, isn't it? We had a wee bit of a joke about this at the end of the last show. And since then, on Friday, I think it was, the thing broke here. And this is a new experience for me to see this kind of like, you know, mass, you know, back crazy paranoia and hysteria that happens. And it grew over 48 hours into, you know, panic and assault onto the supermarkets and cleaning them out. And, you know, they stopped some of the Serie A games at the weekend. They took took the holy water out of the church.
Really?
They closed the Duomo. They've closed museums. They've closed all the schools and universities. And bars at 6 o'clock have to close because the famous happy hour aperitivo is too touchy-feely in Italy, and that's not good. So wow. They're throwing the kitchen sink at this, you know, and it's interesting. As I say, I'm learning as I go here, but it's interesting because for 48 hours, you know, we were the country that was the most reliable and close to the West that had this, and people were panicking and everybody was wondering whether they were going to get through it, and they were seriously scared. And I think the mood music, and this is interesting, I think, for our day jobs, Grant, the mood music's changed a little bit in the last day, which has gone from that to something along the lines of, you know, this isn't going to kill you unless you're an old person. The kind of like death rate is very, very low compared to even normal flu. But what is going to kill us is shortage of logistics and beds and things like that. So let's make sure we don't get involved in any kind of like spreading of it. Stay in your house, not because it's fatal, but because we've only got 4,000 beds and you know, the numbers could get into the hundreds of thousands, and that's just not going to be sustainable. So, you know, I think that's where we are, Grant. I think the mood music's changed the last day.
Yeah, for the positive or for the negative?
Well, like I say, I think for the positive, people are no longer thinking they're not going to make it. Let's hope the country doesn't collapse under the logistics needs to have people in hospitals recovering, which they will recover, but they'll still need to be there. Shops closed, bars closed. All the companies have said to their people to do smart working, so they're obviously going to have some kind of like disruption shock in terms of productivity and everything like that. So that's the change. It's the change of I'm not going to die, but it's going to take a hell of an effort to keep the economy and society logistically in place.
Well, it's interesting, you know, if that is the arc in Italy, from nothing to panic and back to being sanguine in a day, I will be very, very surprised. I suspect you're going to see another leg up in cases being reported. I mean, this is what we've seen everywhere, right? The initial thing, and then everyone tells you it's okay, and then it kind of dies down. Then you get this bump in logistics, and then the fear comes back. I mean, I'd be amazed, Rog, to be honest, if you're now on the path to everyone being calm about it, saying, oh, well, it's okay, it's just a logistical problem.
Well, I was in the hospital today for another thing. It was just a check-up on a small thing I had, an operation I had last week.
Don't worry, check-up on that small thing you had. Maybe you can ask him to swap it for a big thing.
So, but the thing is, in Italy, and this I don't think a lot of people understand, you know, Italy in many ways is a superficial, you know, we'll sort it out type country. Don't worry. Let's go on with having a laugh. But when health is involved, they're much more preventative than other countries, certainly in my experience, the UK. So, you know, I was at a hospital today and it was for this other checkup, and she received me with a mask on, and she said, look, you know, my view of this as a medical practitioner is that more people than we think have got this thing, but less people are going to be affected seriously. So that's the mindset that they believe that, you know, I've seen you talking about this, you know, is it just a normal flu? Today, people in Italy are thinking it is a normal flu. It will need to be treated, and that may cause us some problems. But it wasn't. It isn't the way we were 36 hours ago, where people were really thinking that they were going to die.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I there are plenty of amateur virologists, it seems, in the world at the moment.
Yeah,
I definitely don't count myself among them. You know, I have no idea. I'm interested to watch it all play out. I mean, I'm obviously from my day job, I'm much more interested in the economic. Consequences of it,
but they'll be huge.
But I think you know, where as far as Italy's concerned, if they're cancelling Serie A games, that's a big step.
Well, not just Serie A games. Juve Inter, which is going to be the title decider more or less, is going to be behind closed doors this weekend. You know, they have thrown the kitchen sink at this, and you know, Italy's in the front line, so I guess I'm a good sample of what is happening in the West. You know, I got a call from my parents today from the UK saying, you know, 3 days later, oh, I hear there's a problem in Italy, which lets me understand that, you know, UK, certainly America, the penny hasn't dropped yet. And here we've kind of like had peak hysteria. And I think we're today at least feeling a wee bit better. Maybe you're right. Maybe there's another leg up.
I hope so. If peak hysteria happens one day after the beginning of hysteria, I'd be very skeptical. But no, I hope you're right. That would be great if you can get it over with and done with in that space of time. That'd be brilliant.
As the Chinese say, and it's, of course, that's ironic. May you live in interesting times.
May you live in interesting times indeed. Well, we certainly got what we wish for.
Did you catch the fact that there's the plague of locusts heading their way as well?
I did. I also saw the there was a plague. I think it was in Saudi or maybe it was in China when they sent an army of ducks after them. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah. 400,000 ducks, I think, something like that.
It sounds like the average English cricket team summer.
No, I'm just saying, like, Mother Nature is sending us a message
here.
Oh, by the way, page 20, there was an earthquake in Cosenza yesterday in the south of Italy. No problem.
Okay. Locusts. No problem. For plagues of locusts, earthquakes, and deadly viruses, something's going on. Well, yeah. Let's get to today's guest, right?
Yes, indeed.
I'm going to allow you to introduce him. I just want to let our listeners know this is going to be the first episode of Are You Not Entertained that will be broadcast entirely in Scottish. So for those of you at home, you might want to get the transcript or put it through the Google Translator. I will do my best.
That's absolutely ridiculous. I've got a beautiful Scottish lil, and you'll hear Duncan in a minute, who sounds like Ewan McGregor. Whereas you've got this estuary English that's some kind of like patois that nobody understands anymore. Unbelievable insults. Unbelievable.
You know me, Roger. I'm one of the most insulting human beings on the face of the planet. That's my MO. Anyway, so let's get back to it. Why don't you introduce Duncan, now you've given away his first name, to our audience.
Yeah, Duncan Castles is a sports journalist, comes from Dundee in Scotland, but has worked internationally at the highest level for the kind of like publications you'll know, The Times, The Observer, Bleacher Report. And he's one of these kind of like what I would call fearless type journalists who will say what he needs to say and not be too scared about what it means back at the ranch. And in fact, taking that attitude, he's developed over the last 2 years what I consider is the leading football podcast for the intelligent fan. Having said that, it does have huge numbers as well of downloads. I think it's about 40,000 a week, which puts us into the shade, obviously. The thing about Duncan is that people trust him. You know, when he talks about what's happening in football, at a macro level, at geopolitical level, but also at micro transfer level, people trust him. He will very rarely take a flyer at something. So I wanted to get him on to talk about all the stuff that's going on in football that a little bit we like to brush under the carpet, that we like to not talk about. And you, especially you being a romantic, Grant, I wanted you to no, it's true. It's interesting this because, you know, you're always looking at the nice side of things and you always look at it from the point of view of it isn't. I'd like to, you know, with Duncan, investigate with you some of the things that are under the bonnet and get your reaction to them.
Well, listen, I would like to just state on the record that only one of us has been referred to as a romantic by Caroline Rowland. So,
well, that was a female thing. That was a kind of Tony Jacklin thing.
I think
it needs to be out there.
It needs to be out there.
Okay.
You identify as a romantic. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's absolutely
You're right. But anyway, listen, Duncan is also a PhD. So I think that's a first on our podcast. So he is referred to as Dr. Duncan or Professor, as you prefer.
Well, as he prefers, I would imagine.
As he prefers. And he is one of the nicest chaps you'll come across. So why don't we bring him in?
Let's do that.
Hello, Duncan.
Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to have you on this podcast. Been wanting to do it for a long time for the reasons we'll get into. I'd like to introduce you to my partner in crime, Grant Williams.
Duncan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invite.
Duncan, I've already mentioned to everybody in the intro a little bit of your background, so no need to go through that again. And I'm sure we'll touch on some of the things as we go through it. You know that today I'd like to discuss with you some of the realities of the more obscure end of football. The things that we like to perhaps wish weren't happening but do happen all the time, and try and give our audience, our listeners, an idea from somebody like you about how the world of football really works. So in wanting to do that, I always believe that you need to give the listener the context of the person that's speaking. So I'd like to start, Duncan, by you explaining to us your background in that beautiful Scottish town of Dundee, which obviously meant that being of your generation, you would have been a supporter of Dundee United, and how that took you into the world of sport, reporting on football, and having the outlook on football that you have today. Take us through a little bit about growing up in Dundee.
Well, my family's all from Dundee. I used to go there frequently to visit my relatives. Mum's one of five sisters. My dad's actually a Dundee supporter. He was ribbing me about this this week, actually. He's been out staying with me for the past couple of weeks. I ended up supporting Dundee United because, one, they were by far the superior team of that era. Two, my uncle was a rabid Dundee United supporter, and he took me to the games when we went through to visit him. I was just trying to work out what my first game was. It was September 1977, Dundee United 3, Motherwell 2 at Tannadice. Paul Sturrock, who was one of my boyhood heroes, scored the first goal. Paul Hegarty, David Neary, Hamish McAlpine, already part of that defence, and obviously Jim McLean, the manager. And I think I was really fortunate to end up watching this team and watching the development of a team that won the Premier League, the Scottish Premier League, for the only time in the club's history in 1983. And I was there on the day they won the title, which is, I think, would still go down as the most exciting Scottish title race in history, in that there were three teams competing to win the title on the final day of the season. We played Dundee at Dens Park. Ralph Milne scored a sensational goal, which I'd encourage any football fans to go on YouTube and watch the opening goal of that game. Very typical of his skills. And the team went on to reach a UEFA Cup final in 1987, which I also attended and watched many of the games on the run to that UEFA Cup final, watched the team beat Barcelona at home at Tannadice Park. And I think Dundee United remain the only team in world football who have a perfect competitive record against Barcelona. Four UEFA Cup ties, four wins. Fortunately, or unfortunately, in some senses, we won't be playing them again in any time in the future, which may be something we'll discuss later. We got close to a European Cup final, 1984, the only time we were in the competition, made the semi-final, beat Roma 2-0 at home, and then lost 3-0 in the away leg in a game in which Roma bribed the referee. One of the relatives of the owner of Roma actually went on record several years later to admit that they had bribed the referee to get a result in that match. But through it all, you had a tactical genius in Jim McLean running the team. Lots of very innovative football, very enjoyable team to watch. A guy who went through his early training as a football coach with Alex Ferguson. I think they shared the room on one of the SFA training camps. And according to Jim McLean, I think he told me this when I interviewed him, Alex Ferguson used to copy his homework reports when he had to do his submissions for that coaching course. And they were great rivals to the period which Ferguson established himself as a top manager. Ferguson was at Aberdeen, won more titles, but actually McLean in the head-to-head had more wins against Ferguson as head-to-head managers. And I think they remain good friends to this day. Again, when I interviewed Jim McLean, he was very positive about Ferguson and how he kept in touch with them and just that rivalry they had. And I think the innovations the two came up with in a period, I think the last great period for Scottish football.
Yeah, Duncan, it's fascinating listening to you talk about that because myself, as a fan of a relatively small club, Fulham, to listen to that and hear you talk about Dundee United like that, in a league that was dominated by the two Glasgow powerhouses, get into those lofty positions, European Cup finals, what is now the Champions League to people listening at home who don't remember it as a European Cup like we all do. What was that like? Did you appreciate the position you were in, the unlikelihood of it all, or did it feel as though it was kind of a destiny? Because I remember when Fulham got to the Europa League final, it was just such an out-of-body experience. I never expected to win the game. We didn't, but it didn't matter. It was just that the fact they got there was really all that mattered.
Well, I actually spent a short period of time working for Fulham. I was between jobs in the newspaper industry. So I was working for the Sunday Times freelance at the same time, but I worked on the club publication side, basically looked after the programme. And it actually was a really enjoyable time because you were based at Motspur Park at the training ground. Yeah. So you had lunch with the players, got to know them and the coaching staff well, and I remember that run to the Europa League final. It was fantastic, and I think you get that sense of something that was completely unexpected for the team, and you've gone into an era when clubs of that size aren't meant to get to European finals. Right, exactly. I think I was too young to. When I was watching Dundee United through that European period, so the 87 final, I would have been just at university at that time. So the appreciation that this was something unique and something I wasn't going to see again wasn't there yet.
Interesting.
Football hadn't changed at that stage. But yeah, I'm glad I had the pleasure of seeing that, and glad I had that experience of watching so much football at a young age and watching a team that were tactically clever. And I think it probably played a part. Certainly developed the love of football through watching that team and the interest in analysing football from that perspective, from having, you know, kind of studied Jim McLean as a hero and immersing myself in what he talked about, what he said about the game. I think I just fell on my feet there, basically.
Duncan, you know that I met Jim McLean at a different phase of his life when he was the owner and chairman of Dundee United. And I think most people would say that he was quite a difficult man. Do you, looking back, have a view about what made him so successful as a coach when clearly his personality was so very, very difficult?
I think he was successful as a coach because he was an innovator. I think he was looking outside football for, you know, things that are standard now, like warm downs after matches. I think he was the first man to bring warm downs in to Scottish professional football. He was using sprint coaches with his players. I remember talking to Maurice Malpas about how they trained as defenders, and Malpas, who was a brilliant international defender and top level player, he said that McLean had them set up, I think, with they'd have six players attacking four or eight players attacking four, to put the pressure on the defenders to outperform and to deal with situations where you wouldn't expect yourself to be in a game. He was a guy who was using pressing tactics early in football. I remember interviewing, and I said to you before this podcast, it was the most enjoyable interview of my life because I got to sit down with a guy I'd admired for years and years and years. But he was talking about, you know, not liking having straight lines, playing in the spaces between lines, the importance of winning the ball as high up the field as possible because you're closer to the opponent's goal, using a tall player off the wing and a shorter player in the central position, so like a Paul Sturrock effectively as a false nine. All of these things that we have heard about as innovations in the last, you know, decade were things he was doing in the 70s and 80s. And you know, you're right about his character, and he would admit that. And there was a sort of tearful element to that interview, and he kind of said he felt guilty about the way he'd been as a man in elements of his life, and he was extremely hard on the players, notorious for that. But he was able to be so because it was an era in which contracts were controlled. Famously put Duncan Ferguson, who was there, you know, one of the many young stars that he brought through the ranks at Dundee United. So he was a great scout, a great developer of youth. But he put Duncan Ferguson in a 10-year contract to try and hold and control him. Ended up getting a £4 million transfer fee to Rangers, which was a British record transfer fee at the time. Yep. But he could be that authoritarian individual because it was an era in which managers still had the power to control the players, because the players didn't have huge salaries. They didn't have freedom of movement. They didn't have social media. They generally didn't have agents. So a lot of those levers of power that have developed in the last 20 years, I guess you could say, just weren't there, which allowed him to focus on his strengths as a tactician, as a pure football coach.
Yeah. Listen, I'm going to take you back to that evening in Rome which people of a younger generation won't understand. The idea that a European Cup, only the winners of a league got in, and if you were a small team that didn't win your league very often, like Sampdoria or Dundee United, to then get to the very end stages of that competition, the excitement that generated was an out-of-body experience, really. So Dundee United get to the semi-final, beat Roma 2-0 at home, and go to the away leg. They have accused Dundee United in the first leg of running so hard they must have been taking drugs, which we'll come on to later in the podcast. I don't think that was actually true. But the point was, they threw out these kind of things. And then, as you say, very famously, they certainly tried to bribe the referee. Whether the referee took the bribe and acted on it, I don't know. But it's certainly clear that they tried. And I would say that in the context that Italian football in those years was very common to those kind of attitudes of whatever it takes. Tell me a little bit about how you feel the world has changed or moved on from those kind of attitudes, Duncan. Do they still exist? If so, is it done in a different way? Is it done in a cleverer way? How much of what we see on these beautifully produced sports programs is the reality of pure football, and how much is it things that are decided before the game even starts?
Look, match fixing is clearly a problem in football. Betting markets, Asian betting markets, overseas betting markets, minor leagues, the monitoring of dubious bets in football is you know, it's well known. We have plenty of cases of footballers who have been banned for getting involved in that activity. It tends to be in the less affluent leagues that these punishments are enforced. It's obviously much harder to, if you're involved in the gambling world, to convince a Champions League player at one of the top clubs who's earning hundreds of thousands of pounds a week to take a fall in a game. But look, the importance of these matches, the importance of the clubs, the importance of football has grown and grown and grown. It's always been the most popular sport in the world, but it's spread around the world. Its grip on television audience, its grip on people's emotions is far larger than it's ever been. And, you know, I credit one of the villains he's presented as of football for his role in that, and that's Sepp Blatter. I think Sepp Blatter, in many ways, if you look at the job he had to do in terms of governance of the sport, making the sport, spreading the sport around the world, taking the World Cup to new continents, changing the rules of the game to protect players. We wouldn't have had Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo if it hadn't been for Sepp Blatter changing the rules of football so that the hatchet men were sent off when they tried to take out the superior skilled player early on in the game. You know, we're talking about Dundee United Aberdeen, those matches, you know, Alex Ferguson would instruct his defenders to go and kick Paul Sturrock straight from kickoff, kick him hard, and try and take him out of the match. And he missed a good chunk of his career because of that. We have Messi and Ronaldo protected because Sepp Blatter changed the rules of the game. And we have a more popular game because we get better entertainment. We watch more skilled players. The football's more exciting because of what he did in terms of the core element of the game. However, what comes alongside that? Well, you now have multiple football clubs in Europe whose turnover is over €500 million a year. And we have a particular problem, you know, of the last decade, is you have football clubs being used as political tools. So you have the two most expensive squads in world football are owned by the Qatar royal family and the Abu Dhabi royal family, two nation-state-owned clubs who have accelerated the pace of spending on wages and transfer fees beyond any level we've seen before, and have broken the rules of the sport in order to try and achieve, and ironically they haven't managed it yet, success of being the first Middle East based owners to win the European Cup, Champions League. And there is, and we've seen this exposed over the last 2 years with the Football League's documents about yeah. Paris Saint-Germain and about Manchester City. And we've seen in this, you know, this month, UEFA, their independent disciplinary bodies punishing Manchester City for faking and exaggerating sponsorship revenues in order to allow them to have the most expensive football squad we've ever seen in terms of transfer fee commitments paid to buy that squad in an attempt to win the Champions League. And that is not about the glory of the game. Abu Dhabi don't own Manchester City because Sheikh Mansour is in love with football. This is an owner who has, I think I'm right in saying, attended one football match in person at the stadium. He is supposed to, he doesn't own the stadium because it's Manchester City Council stadium, and there's a discussion to be had there about naming rights, massive payments from Etihad, whether they came from Etihad, going to a stadium that Manchester City Council built and owned, yet the money going into the football club itself. But he's only been to one match. The reason that Abu Dhabi own that football club is, as former chief executive Gary Cook, the man who was chief executive when yep. they bought the club, said in a recent interview, it's a proxy brand for the state, for advertising purposes for Abu Dhabi and for soft power purposes for Abu Dhabi. Same story with Paris Saint-Germain and Qatar's ownership of Paris Saint-Germain. And that, I think, changes the dynamic of football in a fundamental way. And it's something, it's caused problems that have not been solved yet. And I'm still not sure they're going to be solved. I think we're in a very interesting time in terms of how football's authorities act against the problems they've caused, and whether they're capable of, to what extent they're capable of bringing them under control.
Duncan, it's so much fascinating stuff there, and I definitely want to come on and talk a lot more about the current problems with financial fair play and the stuff that's going on in Manchester City. But I want to go back a little bit in what you were just talking about there, back to Sepp Blatter, because first of all, it's fascinating to hear you talk about the positive things that he's done, which are undeniable. You know, what you just outlined, particularly in protecting these skillful players. I happened to tune into a late night thing in England that was showing an old Chelsea Leeds game from the 70s, and the battering that Alan Clark and Peter Lorimer were taking from Ron Harris and stuff was just, I mean, it was shocking to watch. But you know, when you go back to that whole FIFA scandal, it was so brazen, not just in the aftermath, but it seemed to be so obvious what was going on in terms of backhanders and envelopes full of cash. And, you know, everybody, it was a running joke that FIFA was the most corrupt organization in sport. And yet, it took so long for anything material to be done about it. And B, it seems as though somehow it's kind of quietly been brushed under the carpet. There was a lot of noise and Blatter stepped down. Platini came in and he's then been tainted. Infantino's still in there, but he's kind of, there's a few things about him.
Yeah.
Do you think that whole FIFA thing was brushed under the carpet? Do you think they kind of got away with it by making Blatter a scapegoat but not really punishing him?
Look, Blatter was punished. Most of the executive committee members of that era have been banned from football, banned from sports. The general secretary, Jerome Valka, banned for 10 years, and his name came up last week the bribery and aggravated criminal mismanagement, inciting aggravated criminal mismanagement charge that was levelled against Paris Saint-Germain president Nasser Al-Khelaifi in Valka's case. So most of the individuals involved were swept aside. I see your point about how much has actually been fixed, in that the biggest, most corrupt of those incidents was the buying of the World Cup by Qatar.
World Cup, yeah, yeah.
It was done in an intelligent fashion by Qatar. They in many ways, they went about covering their trails quite cleverly. But what happened as an end product was Gianni Infantino moves from UEFA, goes into FIFA, takes over as president, and Qatar end up having the World Cup regardless. So in a sense, the biggest crime went unpunished. And you'll find plenty of people in football saying that FIFA is still a problem. And, you know, you just have to look at the way that FIFA is now trying to muscle into or extend its scope across the club game, massively expanding the Club World Cup, threatening to try and take the revenues from the Champions League and sort of suggesting you could have a global Super League, which FIFA would run instead of UEFA. Being involved in talks with Real Madrid, still arguably the most powerful of the European clubs, to that effect. Looking to take money from Saudi Arabia, for example, to fund some of these tournaments. And what are they doing in terms of adapting the rules of the game to improve the sport? I guess the biggest change to the rules of the game that Infantino has brought in, and it was part of his election campaign, is VAR. And anyone who listens to the Transfer Window podcast, which myself and Ian McGarry do 3 times a week, will know that we have been very much anti-VAR from the start, pointed out the problems that it would cause. And I think we've seen them coming to the fore through this first season that's been in place in the Premier League. And we've seen the kind of ridiculous propaganda that FIFA have used to try and support the introduction of VAR, the claim that there were only 3 mistakes made in the last World Cup because VAR got all but those 3 decisions correct. Anyone who watched the World Cup in any detail will have seen more than 3 refereeing mistakes that were made by VAR during that tournament. So yeah, I take your point that although we had this big investigation, and I think the details of how that came about are very interesting. Good friend of mine, Philippe Auclair, works for France Football, did a huge amount of research and journalism on this. And essentially, it was the American government, in his view, deciding to expose the information about how the World Cup was bought that brought FIFA down. Why did they do that? Because the United States lost out in the World Cup, and a decision was made at a government level in the United States, according to Philippe, to leak that information to journalists and allow this the process of cleaning out FIFA to take place.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting to me, there's something I think in the human psyche that we kind of expect people to cheat in business, right? We kind of expect bribes when it's big business and corporates and what have you. There's something in the human psyche, particularly amongst sports fans, that cheating in sports is somehow worse. And you know, you talk about Qatar. It was proven, I think, beyond any doubt that World Cup was bought. And to the average sports fan, the punishment should be you lose the World Cup. You don't end up getting a slap on the wrist, but you end up with the World Cup. Yeah, how do you feel that was handled? Because I just think that every sports fan, certainly every football fan I spoke to, is adamant that remains a disgrace and they got away with this and no one's really been hauled over the coals for it.
Yeah, look, I very much in favour of the World Cup being broadened out to different continents. First World Cup I covered as a journalist was Korea-Japan in 2002. Amazing experience being in Korea and watching that heading team. African World Cup, I mean, brilliant. It's been a positive for the sport, but to take the World Cup to Qatar is madness. To have the World Cup going on during the middle of the European season with all the complications that involves, insane. The temperatures that will be played in, you know, it's not, the arguments are it's not even going to be safe for spectators, never mind the people on the field. You're right, it should have been taken away. That should have been the outcome when FIFA was cleaned up. But what do you find? What you find is Qatar are major players in football finance and football broadcasting rights. Gianni Infantino is the same as his predecessor as president. He although the way in which you are elected president has changed, the way in which the executive committee is elected has changed, he still needs to have the support of an electorate. And that electorate can be influenced by the distribution of money. Therefore, my view is that it makes sense for Infantino to get as much money under FIFA's control as possible, with him at the head of that organisation, controlling the distribution of that cash. Therefore, if Qatar have a lot of money and a lot of influence in the game, perhaps it's expedient for him to say, well, it's too late to do anything about the World Cup. The contracts have been signed. The stadiums are already being built. We can't afford the legal complications of it. So we just have to go ahead with it. And please don't ask me about that anymore.
But yeah, it just feels like such a cop out to me. And I'm here. You guys are in the business of sport, and I'm here as the sports fan. And you know, from that perspective, when you look at this, it just feels to me that there, at some point, I understand the money side of it. I understand why it's so important to court the cash and have the guys willing to back these big tournaments and make money. Obviously, I get that. But at some point, I just feel as though there is a lot more capital to be made, not physical and financial capital, but capital with the fan base by coming in and cleaning house and really doing something that the fans can appreciate purely for the love of the game. They can see, you know what, this is someone who's coming in and he is going to take the World Cup away from Qatar and he is going to punish those. And we really are going to clean house here, because I don't think anyone that I've spoken to about this, and over the last 2 or 3 years, obviously, I've had a lot of conversations about this. Everybody feels like the whole thing was poorly handled. It was a disgrace the way they got away with it. The fact they've still got the... You know, the fans are united in their loathing for the governing body. And at some point, this has to be more than about money. Surely it has to be about, okay, how do we get the fans on side?
True, but the fans don't elect the president of FIFA. The fans don't elect the president of UEFA.
There you go.
The fans don't elect, apart from a few clubs, the president of the football clubs. So the power they have is not democratic in most cases. And I think Roger can talk about this far better than I can as someone who was in charge of a football league. There are a lot of vested interests and a lot of issues to be solved when you are running these governing bodies. And it's not always simple to do the most logical, cleanest thing that the fans might want to happen. And sometimes the fans might, you know, their idea of how a club should be run could be difficult. So you can look at the fan ownership model is great, but you can look at a club like Barcelona at present and you see a club that's kind of enthralled to the electorate and a range of bad decisions being taken by Josep Bartomeu in charge of that club, with the view to how he retains his position of power at Barcelona. What will appeal to the fans? How can he control his image so that he gets re-elected? there are, you know, there are complications with a democratic ownership model as well in a sport as emotional as football, where you have a result twice a week and judgments are made on the quality of players, quality of the club, quality of management, quality of ownership, quality of directorate on a, you know, bi-weekly basis.
I think this is you're hitting the nail on the head here, Duncan, that most people don't understand that the governance and the democratic setup of football is set up basically for the kind of things that we see, you know, whether it's votes for power or votes for tournaments or quid pro quos all over the place, or whether it's some of the things we alluded to earlier, or it's one of the things I'd like to bring up now, which is this. You know, we've seen in the last little while an awful lot of stuff about people pushing the envelope in terms of performance enhancing. You know, we've even had the Panorama program this week about Salazar and Mo Farah. In football, I think it would be safe to say, would it not, Duncan, that many clubs and many famous operators have gone as close to they can to the edge of legality to get that edge. And in this case, when they succeed, I don't think the fans are that bothered. What do you think?
Look, football obviously has a problem with performance-enhancing drugs. I think you can go back in history and see accusations of its use in the German teams of, I think, the 50s. You've got the example of a Scotland player at the 1978 World Cup being sent home for using performance-enhancing drugs.
I think he tested positive for iron brew. I think it was just. I don't think it was on the list of banned substances at the time. In fairness,
the testing regime is not particularly rigorous. There are lots of complaints that it's made easier than it should be to use performance-enhancing substances if you decided you wanted to do that. Okay, let's pick a famous name in football who has been found guilty of taking performance-enhancing drugs, who has a criminal conviction that subsequently cleared for taking performance-enhancing drugs. Pep Guardiola, 2001, tested positive twice for taking nandrolone, an anabolic steroid, when he was playing in Italy. In Serie A. His original version of why that happened was, and I'm quoting here, "I only took the multivitamins that Dr. Ramon Segura, my trusted physiologist, has prepared for me for 6 or 7 years." So he got a 50,000 euro fine from the Italian authorities and a 4-month suspension. And he attempted to defend himself on 3 separate occasions. The first occasion, Segura, the physiologist, testified saying that the supplements he'd given Guardiola had been contaminated. And the Italian prosecutors tested some samples that Segura gave him of supplements that plant had been contaminated, and they didn't find any nandrolone in those supplements. He subsequently got a 7-month suspended prison sentence. He then tried to contest that, arguing that he suffered from a condition called Gilbert syndrome, which resulted in the endogenous production of nandrolone. That was thrown out by the courts as well. 2007, he was finally cleared. Because his assistant, Manuel Esteriarte, found that there were changes in the WADA regulations. They found that there was a syndrome called unstable urine, and that it was possible that because of a chemical reaction in vials of urine, nandrolone could be produced in the vial, which hadn't actually been produced by the athlete. They brought in a system where you would have stability tests on urine samples if the nandrolone level was between 2 and 10 nanograms per milliliter. Guardiola's original sample had been 12, so he was above the level where the urine would have needed to be tested for stability. One expert said there was a 1 in 1,000 chance or 1 in 10,000 chance that you would get this urine instability happening in any particular vial. He was cleared because his samples were too old to test again to see if they were unstable. That's how he eventually got the charge removed. Segura, when Guardiola was appointed Barcelona coach, Segura was used by Barcelona as a doctor for the team. So the individual that Guardiola had said was responsible for him testing positive was then someone he was happy to work with and happy to hand out supplements to his players when he became a coach of a top-level European club. In 2010, Barcelona were fined €30,000 by UEFA for failing to provide details of the players' whereabouts, basically avoiding anti-doping tests. When he went to Manchester City in his first season, the FA fined Manchester City £35,000 because in three times in a five-month period, they broke anti-doping regulations. So that's a very prominent individual in football who was found guilty of doping and who's been involved in two cases of breaches of anti-doping regulations at teams which are regarded as being absolute forefront of football, playing some of the best football we've ever seen, are praised to the heavens by the majority of football commentators for the quality of their play.
But what's the point, Roger? I know you're going to want to come in. Just one quick question: what's the point of fining Manchester City £35,000?
Well, it's a very good question. What is the point of fining them less than they pay some of their academy players a week?
Yeah, I mean it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but as I say, the regime that to clamp down on performance enhancing drugs in football is not as rigorous as you would like it to be, but football's not the only top level sport that has that problem. I know you guys talk about rugby a lot. For me, and we have former international rugby players who are very open about talking about the problems rugby has and the massive increase of size of players during the professional era. Yeah, and you got player of the former French international testifying about how he played South Africa in a test match, and I think he said over 2/3 of the team had therapeutic use exemptions because they suffered from asthma. Spent a fair amount of time in South Africa. I haven't met that many asthma sufferers. It's quite a warm, dry climate. It's not the sort of climate where you get this that kind of Scottish problem for asthma, and certainly you wouldn't expect that prevalence of asthma issues in a top level sports team.
You know, Duncan, this is why I wanted to get you on here, because those of us that are in the industry, we hear conversations that are kind of like delivered en passant that I think most football fans would make their jaws drop. Along the lines that you're talking about, and if I throw in a name like Fuentes, the famous Spanish doctor who, I think without any possible contradiction has influenced a generation of Spanish sports stars. What happens to him when he gets close, the story gets close to him working with some Spanish clubs, the very biggest Spanish clubs, the story goes away, doesn't it?
Yeah. And look, this is a problem that top sports have. It's difficult. If you're reporting on football or rugby, cycling on a regular basis, and you're reporting on the sport, and you start reporting on the dirtier side of the sport, then your access will go away pretty quickly in most cases. So you've got to, it's almost needs outsiders to do the reporting of these kind of issues and put the pressure on the governing bodies and on the clubs and the individuals themselves to clean up their game. There's another question, which I guess you guys have discussed on this podcast before, is to what extent do the supporters actually want it cleared up? Do rugby Yep. followers want rugby played as it was when I was watching rugby when I was at university, where, you know, the fly half wouldn't be much bigger than I am, you know, 5'7", playing Yeah. an international rugby match. And you had that balance of you know, big players and normal physiques, smaller, quicker physiques. Does the average rugby supporter want to go back to that era, or do they prefer the, you know, the visceral thrill of watching big guys knock lumps off each other, and the bigger and the faster and the harder the better?
That's fascinating. I find that fascinating because I think the first question, you only have to look at that fabulous YouTube video of the 1970s All Blacks doing the haka to answer that question. We definitely don't want to go back to that. But you know, that this question, I think, is such a fundamental one in terms of the fans. You know, what do they want? Because I don't think the fans think about it that way. I don't think anyone thinks about what happens if this goes away. I think if you're a sports fan, you have an instinctive and intuitive sense of fair play. And there's something about it. If you follow,
I don't think that's right, Grant. I don't think that's right.
I disagree with you, Roger. But let me finish the point. I don't think the fans think about, if all the dodgy stuff goes away, we're going to go back to watching. Not from a team perspective. I don't think Man City fans would think. Oh, if the money goes away, we're going to be fighting relegation again. I totally get that. But I think from a sport down, top down perspective, I don't think any fans are thinking about rugby's going to go back to a bunch of small guys running around and it's not going to be as thrilling. I just don't think that's the way fans think about it. I think
let me give you an example Grant. It takes it away to more the realpolitik, which is around transfers. And this is something Duncan can give us a real insight into. It's his core competence. But, you know, ever since, you know, the old days even, you know, he likes a bong, that manager will take a bong, to the more systematic stuff that, again, those of us in the industry hear about, very, very well-known coaches systematically having payments made to bank accounts for transfers to take place. Let me give you, I don't think the fans care about that as long as these big names are arriving at their clubs. Let me give you an example of that, why I think that's the case. You look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer now and who he's doing most of his transfer business with. You would think, and I'll ask Duncan to carry on the story here, but you would think that would be something that the kind of fan that you're describing, Grant, would have an issue with. But no. You know, it doesn't bother them that, you know, this chap from China who is also in quarantine, I mean, ridiculous story, you know, comes from an agent that Solskjaer uses very, very consistently and who, by the way, set up the same agency with him years earlier. Duncan, tell us a little bit about why this has not become a much bigger story than it is.
Well, the Odion Ighalo transfer, it's actually it's a business partner of Jim Solbakken, who's been Solskjaer's agent throughout his career as footballer and as manager, who worked with Ighalo and did that deal. Obviously, Manchester United tried to sign Josh King from Bournemouth, another kind of bizarre transfer if you think about the qualities of the player and the ability of Manchester United to spend on far more storied individuals. He was a player that Solskjaer brought to Manchester United as a kid with Solbakken as the agent I would say in this case, actually, there are quite a lot of Manchester United fans who are very interested in it. But they're interested in it because they're unhappy with Solskjaer as a manager. And it becomes a tool to put pressure on him and to underline to other supporters who are still supportive of him that they might be being sold a pup in Solskjaer. And you can go back. This has been very well detailed by a Norwegian football magazine called Josimar. They've done a piece called The Double Agent. And they talk about Solbakken and Solskjaer running a player's agency together for a good chunk of his career. Solskjaer forced to relinquish his shares in the agency when he moves to England by the FA because of conflict of interest. But a huge number of players being recruited throughout Solskjaer's career, particularly pertinent when he moves to Cardiff City as a Premier League manager for the first time. He buys, I think, three players who are sold back and clients who play just a handful of games in the Premier League after signing for him. And these are players who should have been bought in to try and help them avoid relegation. They eventually end up going down. Look, football's, as you know, Roger, it's set up in a way. I'm not aware of another industry where you have, Neymar deal. We are talking 222 million euros as a transfer fee, a contract worth another 100 million euros, plus agents' fees, commission. So you're looking at well over 350 million euros of total deal value. And that is being negotiated by people who don't actually own the club quite often. In Neymar's case, not so much because it's Qatar, but you will often get a scenario where the chief executive of a football club or the person responsible for doing a deal that is worth hundreds of millions of pounds is not the owner of the club and has control over a transfer where major sums are being paid in commissions. And there are opportunities for those commissions to be kicked back in certain areas, which does happen in football. Not saying it happens all the time, not even saying it happens the majority of time, but it does happen from time to time. And football's particularly ripe for this because the deals have reached such a huge scale and the actual individuals who have ownership of the club quite often are not negotiating those deals and going through the fine detail of the contracts themselves.
So,
but I think you're right, Roger. I think the fans aren't particularly interested in that most of the time, as long as the players they perceive to be improving their team are coming to their clubs. And you know, one of the other ironies of the transfer market is if you go through those record deals in football, you could probably say half of them have been failures. You go through the top 10 biggest transfers of all time, a big chunk of them have been major misses by the clubs doing those deals.
I think you've hit the nail on the head here because I don't think fans are that bothered as long as there's a saying in Italy, I don't care whether he's the devil as long as he's got dollars in his back pocket. You know, I think that's much more prevalent than the way Grant thinks that, you know, fans have this inherent sense of fair play. I don't believe that for one second. And this is where I would like to segue to come back to Man City. And I'm going to play devil's advocate with you here, Duncan. You know my real view on this, but I want to try and be balanced on this. We've described a situation of pretty much whatever it fucking takes, you do it to get ahead in sport and certainly in football, right? So why should we give the Man City boys such a hard time for expanding some sponsorship contracts and maybe spending more than they should have when, you know, we know the Russian teams and Gazprom did it and Infantino closed an eye. We know that Paris Saint-Germain, you know, the whole FIFA Jerome Valk thing. We know that Real Madrid sold their training ground for an inflated fee so that they could get their finances back into shape. Why all of a sudden have we got the bit between our teeth? Is it racist, Duncan?
I think the reason Manchester City have got into trouble is that there's documentary evidence of
they just got caught. They just
got transgression.
Caught.
They got caught in a fashion that they have been unable to successfully defend as yet, and they're going to spend a vast amount of money trying to defend that. And their strategy has obviously been, we're not going to defend ourselves thoroughly at UEFA. We're going to take it to what we describe as an independent court. And you know, there was a clear intimation in their first statement that the appeal to CAS is at the first instance. So if that one doesn't work, then they go to a state court or a European Union court to try and win their case. And you know, in those documents, you have the general counsel, the chief lawyer at Manchester City, sending a message saying, Al Mubarak, who is the chairman of Manchester City and also a very senior politician in Abu Dhabi, telling Gianni Infantino, who was the general secretary of UEFA at the time and eventually did a deal with Manchester City in 2014, that they pay €60 million and take a few squad restrictions and clear the case, saying he would rather spend £30 million on the 50 best lawyers in the world to sue them for the next 10 years. You know, that was the explicit threat to UEFA. If you take us on, if you want to go down the line on this, we will try and destroy you with our financial power. You know, you have another email there which fits into how you introduced this, which is Simon Pearce, who is a Manchester City director and also very prominent in the governments of Abu Dhabi.
Very prominent.
Telling the financial officer at Manchester City, when he's asking about backdating the payments from sponsors to try and adhere to FFP, saying, of course, we can do what we want. So that was the attitude. We can do whatever we want. There is clearly a problem that Paris Saint-Germain have got away with their transgressions of FFP, and they managed to use a technicality in the UEFA rules to win at CAS. And that there's an interesting element in what will happen in the CAS case, in that the people who found Manchester City guilty of transgressing FFP rules were an independent investigatory chamber who recommended a Champions League ban, and then an independent adjudicatory chamber, which is made up of a lot of very senior, experienced lawyers. You know, you can go through the list and it makes Manchester City's argument that they were prejudiced and out to get City a bit ridiculous, because you're talking about the reputations of some very senior people in the legal world, and suggesting that they, you know, they decided that City were guilty. They decided from the start, and they were always going to hammer them this way. But when it goes to CAS, those people won't be defending their judgment. It's up to UEFA to make the case to argue against whatever Manchester City's team of very expensive lawyers, and they've apparently hired one of the individuals, David Panic, who was involved in winning against Boris Johnson and some of the Brexit shenanigans. Shows you the kind of money they're prepared to throw at this. UEFA will have to decide to what extent they want to defend that judgment. And that brings in the element of, is there a political solution here? Will UEFA want to go as hard themselves against Manchester City in CAS, knowing that Manchester City have them in their sights, knowing that they only have control, definite control of the Champions League until 2024, knowing that there's huge pressure from Juventus and some of the most storied clubs European football to change the format of the Champions League.
Old money.
Knowing knowing that Real Madrid are in open talks with FIFA about this World Super League, and there is a potential there that UEFA have all of this stripped away from them, and they lose the Champions League, they lose the most enjoyable, the best club football there is, and their big cash cow.
So they're going to cave, Duncan. You're saying they're going to cave.
I'm not saying they're going to cave. I'm saying that there are lots of elements still in play here. And I think it's interesting that the people, that independent adjudicatory chamber who came to the decision, will not be the people defending their decision in court against CAS, against Manchester City, sorry.
So Duncan, do you think this ultimately goes where they just find a compromise? I mean, is this about justice and what's right anymore, or is this about finding a compromise where everybody kind of saves face and gets away with it, and you know, it's just fudged?
Look, a lot of people were. I talked to people in UEFA while this process was going after the Football Leaks information came out, and it was clear that within UEFA there were two camps, and one camp was, right, this has to be investigated properly. We now have documentary evidence. We know that Manchester City were breaking the rules. And you know, these are fundamental rules. They're part of the competition rules of the Champions League. And the majority of clubs adhere to those rules. And they wanted the investigation, and they wanted a Champions League ban. They felt that the only way you can bring a club with such financial resource into check is to remove them from the competition they want to win. And I think they're right about that. That is the only real effective punishment you can have there. And then it was clear there was another group who were scared of the consequences. And there was the possibility that there would be a fudged solution, a punishment that would be acceptable to Abu Dhabi, Manchester City, and it gets forgotten about after a while. But they've had, you know, the ban is there, the two-year ban is there. I think the two-year ban is clever because it allows CAS to reduce the ban and still keep them out of the Champions League competition. A lot of the information coming out was that it would be the recommendation would be for a one-year ban, and I was surprised when they handed down a two-year ban, but I think that's clever. But yeah, there's a lot more elements at play than the pure facts of the case is my view of it.
As always.
Indeed.
So Duncan, let's assume you're right, and it comes down to a fudge of 1 year to try and save everybody's face. And you're absolutely right. UEFA is between a rock and a hard place here, because there are some existential threats to what has been has been a monopoly over European football for 50 years. And whether it's between private equity money, sovereign wealth money, or FIFA itself, they're under enormous threat. And is this the moment to put a kind of like a flag in the ground that, you know, they shall not pass? I don't think they'll do that. So they will come out with 1 year. Where does that leave then Man City and Guardiola and those players? And how do you see the next 12 months of two transfer windows panning out? Not just for Man City, because it then obviously knocks on to a whole lot of other clubs.
Well, it is a big problem for Manchester City in terms of retaining the players. And we've done a few episodes of the Transfer Window podcast recently talking about that. Obviously, Ferran Soriano, the chief executive, went to the players immediately the day of the verdict, Valentine's Day. I thought it was quite funny by UEFA to hand down the verdict, their Valentine's massacre on the 14th of February. So he went to the players and assured them, we are innocent of this. You will not be excluded from the Champions League. Don't worry. We are going to win this case. Tried to reassure them. But, you know, the players are not stupid. They have heard Manchester City. That's been the argument since these documents came into the public domain, since the reporting started. That has been Manchester City's consistent line, that that the allegations were untrue and that they would win You have Pep Guardiola on multiple occasions talking about how the chief executive and the chairman had assured them that they hadn't broken the rules and he trusted them. And the expectation was there would be no Champions League ban. But the players are seeing the prospect of not being able to compete in the top competition, the one they want to win, for the next 2 years. And they're wanted by the top clubs. So we talked about Bernardo Silva. Bernardo Silva is wanted by Barcelona for obvious reasons. For, in my view, best player in the Premier League last season. Really good fit to Barcelona football. Barcelona had inquired about him before the ban and been told absolutely no chance you can get this player, central to Manchester City's plans. Pep Guardiola loves him. He won't let him go. We're not going to let him go. Forget about it. But now there's a chink of light. There's, well, can Manchester City persuade that player to stay? They're proposing solutions where Manchester City players, a lot of their salary is based on having qualified for the Champions League and playing in the Champions League. So a big chunk of their income is dependent on that. And there's an obvious solution, which is, you know, don't worry, we will pay you that money regardless of whether you're in the Champions League. That will sort them out financially, but you can't sort them out from a sporting perspective. And the players will be asking questions about the ramifications down the line for the players alongside them. How strong can this team be? Will Pep Guardiola remain there in that scenario? He's, you know, the noises from Pep Guardiola's camp is he will stay regardless. But, you know, you, Roger, came on the podcast, our podcast, last year, and told us about the pre-contract that that Pep Guardiola has with the Agnelli family, and absolutely there is an open invitation from Juventus that when he goes to Italian football, which he's on record as saying he would like to coach in, the job is his. So that comes into play as well. Will Guardiola remain?
So Duncan, let's just let the listeners understand this then about what all this means to the Realpolitik. You've got an example you've just given there that a club like Juventus would, let's say, be more than happy if the troubles of Man City continue and the ban is extended, because that means the likelihood of Guardiola arriving in Turin to be much higher. You've got other clubs and other investors saying how much they love financial fair play because it's taken volatility out of football. It has allowed a level of profitability that was never there, and that financial fair play is indeed the cornerstone of making this sport quote unquote investable from a financial point of view. And on the other side, you've got Man City, you've got Simon Pearce, you've got every fucking lawyer they can get their hands on, and they are, you know, screwing the nuts of poor UEFA in such a way that, as I say, this is the story in football of the last 10 years, and it will decide what our industry looks like for the next 20, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. And financial fair play is not a perfect system, but it did achieve what it was set out to achieve, which was to increase the profitability of football. And the numbers are very stark there. When it came in to play, you're looking at losses of over, I think it was 1.6 billion euros collectively. In the European leagues, net loss in 2011 of 1.67 billion, and turning that into a profit, net profit of 579 million in 2017. So the stated aim has been achieved. There are big complications in that it's kind of congealed power to those bigger clubs, the clubs who have historic wealth, large fan bases, are in the right markets. And you've got, you know, problems with Juventus repeatedly winning the Italian league, Paris Saint-Germain repeatedly winning the French league. You've got Liverpool and Manchester City putting absolute dominant performances in the English league in recent years in a way we've never seen before. So those are side effects of FFP. But if you take the Manchester City argument, the Manchester City argument is owners should be allowed to put as much money in as they want, as long as it's equity and the clubs don't go into debt. And it should be pure free competition. Spending is good for football. The more that's invested in the game, it's better for football. You get better product on the field. Why would anyone not want that? That if that is allowed to go unfettered, you have, I think, a very bad situation for football, because the transfer market inflation you get, the salary inflation you get, is immense. And it makes it impossible or very, very hard for any club that doesn't have one of those sugar daddy owners. And you know, we're talking, I think it's only nation states that are capable of doing this now. Yeah. So Saudi Arabia are looking to buy a football club. They would be able to compete on a something like a level playing field with Abu Dhabi and Qatar. But they, if FFP hadn't come in, they could drive the transfer fees higher and higher to the level where Liverpool's, Manchester United, Real Madrid just couldn't compete with their own revenues they produce. And then what happens to the game? It becomes a tool for nation states who are using it as a proxy brand or for geopolitical purposes. FFP isn't perfect, but I'd much rather have FFP than that scenario.
Agreed.
I've got to bring this back if I can, and I apologise if you can hear outside the noise. I've got leaf blowers outside, which is driving me nuts, so I'm sure it's driving you, so I apologise for that. But I've got to bring you back if I can, Duncan, because we've taken up so much of your time, but I'd love to just talk about Fulham if I can a little bit, because that's what I love to do, because I'm a Fulham fan. Just talk a little bit about the club itself, because I was in a very fortunate position back in December of taking a bunch of people there for some kind of quasi corporate entertainment, who most of them were from the US, had never been to a football match, and it's such a special club for neutrals, for people who just love the game, or people who don't understand the game. Talk a little bit about your time at Fulham, what you saw there, what makes the club special, and don't be afraid to pander to my overt fandom.
tell them who they're going to buy and whether they're going up, Duncan. Tell them the transfer stuff.
Not whether they're going up. Not whether they're going up. Just tell me they're going up.
Look, we have to be honest. We don't do a lot of focus on Championship football and Fulham in the transfer podcast. We're very much Premier League, Champions League. Clubs with large supports.
Said the Dundee United
take the
fan.
L.
Yeah, we don't report on Dundee United very often either. Look, the location's fantastic, isn't it? And that stadium, which they've managed to maintain the atmosphere of, the feel of, through that period in the Premier League, I think it was the most enjoyable stadium. When I was based in London for a long time as a reporter, and I found the most enjoyable stadium, certainly to walk to, and as the atmosphere in the ground and the feeling of being in the ground, probably the best one from a crowd noise point of view was White Hart Lane, the old White Hart Lane. Portsmouth was really good, Fratton Park at the time, and there you've got another story of dubious investors in football and what happens when you're allowed unfettered spending and the damage it can do. They almost destroyed that football club. It had a family feel about it and a special feel about it, both in the stadium and, as I talked about, that experience of spending time at Motspur Park at the training ground. I have a fondness for the club. An interesting scenario with the owner and where he wants to go in football. And that attempt to buy Wembley. I think it's pretty clear he wants to bring NFL, be one of the men, brings an NFL franchise to London. And I wonder, and this is just supposition really, I wonder how long he will be in charge of Fulham from that perspective, and whether he might even think about buying another London club at some point.
Duncan, I don't think so. I think he's, you know, the whole Fulham peer thing, you know, I really think he's going to make a go of it. And, you know, I think if, I think if they can get up, which they should do, and they can stay a couple of seasons up there, I think they can be quite a juicy club for a future where you can attract players, where you've got a real estate play, a beautiful location. You know, I'm very bullish on Fulham, and I just think that, you know, like so many of these things, their future is dependent on a few goals or referee decisions or penalties, you know, in the last 3 months of this season. Because if they don't get up this year, I'm not sure, you know, it's going to be that easy.
Yeah, I agree with you. Goals, look, goals are the problem.
I think the question for Championship clubs and lower end Premier League clubs, which is what Fulham, you know, at their best are going to be a mid-table. If you get all the organisation right, you can make them a mid-table Premier League club. I think the question for them is what happens if the Super League comes about. And if the Super League gets a chunk of the Premier League revenues and a chunk of the focus away from the Premier League, then the Championship becomes a difficult financial proposition. And most of these clubs are being run at huge losses at present. Gambling to try and get into that Premier League money base. If the Premier League loses its shine and its ability to hold on to broadcast revenue and whatever internet streaming revenue replaces the majority of broadcast revenue down the line, then the scenario for Championship clubs, I think, becomes very different. And the scenario for some of the Premier League clubs at the lower end becomes very different. And that's that, you know, we've talked about the Super League and where football goes, that tension between the Premier League and the top clubs in the Premier League, where they decide to break, whether they decide to break for a European Super League or whether they try and hold the Premier League's prominence at present, is going to be an important factor in determining where football goes in the next 10, 15, 20 years.
100%. And of course, that's a great excuse for us to say, well, you'll need to come on again and tell us about that a little bit, maybe in 6 months' time or something, because that's a lifetime in sport these days and media contracts and rights cycles. Duncan, this is everything I hoped it would be and more. In thanking you, I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit about where people can find this wonderful podcast of yours, the Transfer Podcast Window Podcast, where three times a week, anybody that really needs to know anything about football and what's happening should tune in, and you don't really need anything else. Tell us where people can find that, and they can find yourself, Duncan.
Yeah, you can find it any podcast platform, the Transfer Window. We have all the usual social media channels, Transfer Podcast on Twitter and on Facebook and on Instagram. It's actually quite a good week for us. I think we're going to go through 2 million listens this week.
Astonishing.
Probably tomorrow. Set up 2.5 years ago, well, less than 2.5 years ago, and we've done 1.6 million of those listens in the last year, so it's been going well. It's a lot of fun. So you can go on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you like, subscribe to Transfer Window and tell us what you think. And myself, I'm on Twitter at Duncan Castles and on Instagram at duncan.castles.
Fantastic. I think a couple of thousand of those listeners are me and Rog. It's a great product. So anyone out there who loves their football, absolutely download and subscribe to it. You won't regret it. Duncan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real treat. I literally looked at the clock a few minutes ago. This has just breezed by, and it feels like we could go on for another. So as Roger said, we'll have to get you back on again, because there's still so much to talk about.
Thank you, and thank you for your kind words. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Duncan, for your time. Take care, my friend.
Fantastic. That was great. Absolutely fantastic.
You like that?
Oh, That was just gold dust. I mean, honestly, I was just a listener for most of that. I was just sitting there listening to it. It was fascinating. And how good to get someone who will just openly talk about clubs and people, and you know, it's fantastic. Really, really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I was really hopeful that we could give our listeners a taste of the kind of conversations that go on in the industry. And you know, there's other ones that, you know, fear of litigation stops you from saying so freely. But you know, there's a lot of things that I think are out there, and I think this gave people a really good idea of what goes on in the engine room of the football industry.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think we all know that wherever there's this kind of money, there is always going to be corruption. Every now and again, it bubbles to the surface. And you know, the strange thing is that the shock and the outrage that accompanies it every time. But you know, for my part, as I said, when we're talking about FIFA, the speed with which it dies down, and the fact that, you know, Blatter's not behind bars, frankly, it's for me as a fan, is always disappointing. But it's great to get a look behind the curtain, because it's even more fascinating than you imagine it to be.
Yeah.
Well,
good stuff.
That's us for another week, Rog. I have to say, I had some cracking goals and own goals this week, but I'm going to save them for next time. It's been a wonderful week for anyone looking for that sort of thing.
we'll definitely keep them.
All that remains is to thank you, the listeners, for sticking with us over the last hour and 30 odd minutes. Hopefully you've enjoyed it as much as we have. Please do rate and review the podcast, share it with your friends. A quick plug also for the Captain's Table. You should definitely listen to that. We had the inimitable Rory McIlroy on this week, talking with Giles Morgan, and it was just fabulous to get to listen to Rory talk about his life outside the golf course and a couple of things he does on the golf course, which will perhaps surprise you. Please follow us.
It was wonderful, really wonderful.
It really was, wasn't it? Please follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR, that's the word, A-R-E. You will find me on Twitter at TTMYGH.
And you'll find myself, always more so, RPM Como, stuck in the lake.
Stuck in the lake. Rog, I hope your freezer's full, and I will talk to you again soon, my friend.
Take care, Grant. Bye-bye.